The British Broadcasting Corporation presents London Letter, in which John Connell, novelist and editorial writer of one of London's daily newspapers, gives his comments on interesting happenings of the week.
This is John Connell from London. We've got a habit, British people I mean, we've got a habit of being a bit sardonic and disillusioned about ceremonial celebrations, exhibitions, jubilees, and all official and semi-official junketings of that kind. Highly disillusioned about them in advance. And then, after they've happened, thoroughly approving and sentimental and affectionate. In my life as a journalist, I've watched these two moods develop time and again, and often I've shared in them. I've seen lots of big occasions come and go. King George V's Silver Jubilee, the coronation of the present King and Queen, the victory celebrations, the Olympic Games. And before each of them, I find myself moodily walking around the house, saying, oh, it's just another commercial ramp, bound to be a complete failure. Times are much too difficult and unpleasant for this sort of carry-on. And we've all agreed solemnly that it's a deplorable farce, and we'll have no part of it. And somehow, on the day, there I've been, in my best clothes, waving a press pass, determined to get the best view and write the best story yet. The fact of the matter is that I, and about 90% of my fellow countrymen, we like these shows and state occasions, but also we're determined to pretend to ourselves and everyone else that we don't. There's a very good example cropping up now. The great new exhibition, which is to be held here in London in 1951, plans for which have just been released this week. So far as I can define it, the general attitude among ordinary people is one of gloomy casualness, a flat and rather somber disregard of the whole project, a stubborn determination not to wax optimistic or enthusiastic, and a blank refusal to appear interested, let alone impressed. However, I'm willing to lay a large bet with anyone rash enough to take me on that when 1951 comes, we shall all rally valiantly. We shall all do our best to make the whole affair a rousing success, and it will be. As I expect you know, 1951 is the 100th anniversary of the Great Exhibition of 1851, that portentous and dazzling show which was like a great beacon across the middle years of the 19th century. Most of us realize now that the 1851 exhibition was an event of no small importance in British history. It called for the creation of the Crystal Palace, that remarkable piece of functional engineering design applied to architecture, which was in fact about 70 years ahead of its time, yet which dominated our ancestors' mental horizons to a really extraordinary degree. Its creator, Robert Paxton, had designed a great many greenhouses and conservatories for the landed gentry of England. And when he was commissioned to build an exhibition hall, he just went away and designed the biggest greenhouse ever seen. And in it, our ancestors housed not begonias and geraniums and orchids, but the bloom and flower of their own creation, the Industrial Revolution. They gave full rein to their exuberant ingenuity and their boundless optimism. And they seem to us, looking back across a century, magnificently sure of themselves, buoyant, certain of their destiny, their power and their inspiration. And the temptation to sit down and boo-hoo and wail that we're not the men they were is quite strong. But how foolish and how baseless. Do we realize here in Britain, the setting and the background against which the Victorians launched this venture? The country was just emerging from the hungry 40s, from years of violent social and political conflict. 3 years back only, the exact period of time, by the by, which lies between us and the 1951 exhibition. 3 years back, there'd been 48, the dread year of Chartism here in England, of the Commune in Paris, of revolution and uprising which tore and distressed half the nations of Europe. No, it didn't seem at all a secure or an easy or a prosperous world into which our ancestors launched the bold venture and challenge of the Great Exhibition. As a challenge and a spur, its sponsors, especially Prince Albert, Queen Victoria's consort, saw it. And such it indeed proved to be. It struck the note of decades of unparalleled zest and achievement in manufacture and invention, in exploration, in art, in material prosperity and spiritual enrichment of every kind. I believe there's a first-rate augury for our own 1951 exhibition in that achievement of its famous predecessor. Plans, as they've been so far revealed, are a bit in the skeleton stage, but they seem to show a very venturesome and undaunted spirit. It's a long time since we had a big exhibition here in London. The Empire Exhibition at Wembley in 1924-1925 was the last. And I was a 15-year-old schoolboy then, going for tremendous rides on the giant racer and whooshing down the water chute. And in 1951, I hope and trust that I shall take my 13-year-old stepson on the same sort of exciting caper. The most important thing about this new exhibition is, I'm quite certain, its site. The choice of this shows the boldest imagination and courage and vision. As I expect most of you know, the north side of the River Thames, that's the Westminster and City of London side, has several miles of imposing embankment, a fine carriageway adorned with monuments, and blessed at every curve with some of the loveliest and noblest river views that any city possesses. Wordsworth remarked on September the 3rd, 1802, standing on Westminster Bridge in the early morning, "Earth has not anything to show more fair. Dull would he be of soul who could pass by a sight so touching in its majesty." And he was quite right, and he'd still be quite right, if he wrote it now in 1948. But the south side, the Surrey side, doesn't, unfortunately, quite maintain this standard. Large stretches of it, seen from the north side, have a distressed, shabby, hugger-mugger, down-at-heel appearance. They display the scars and the squalor of 19th century industrialism at its least prepossessing. A very typical stretch of this wasteland, or near wasteland, has been chosen as the site for the exhibition. It's some 30 acres, lying between Waterloo and Hungerford Bridges, right opposite the Savoy Hotel, opposite the Strand, within astonishingly easy reach of the West End and the centre of London. The London County Council have been authorised by the government to spend up to $8 million on clearing and preparing this site. I gather the exhibition buildings will probably be temporary structures of steel and glass and plastic, and when the show's over, they'll go to make way for a permanent reconstruction of the whole area, which is what it's needed for the past 50 or 60 years. I believe, too, the general theme of the exhibition is to be one of hopefulness and gusto, and I hope that'll be reflected in the buildings. In all the sketches I've seen so far, there have been some rather handsome rafts depicted, lying out in mid-Thames. I hope these'll be there in reality, and I hope they'll be floodlit at night, or used for firework displays. For one of the loveliest shows I ever remember was the Victory Night firework display in the Thames, which I saw from the terrace of the House of Commons. In general, the exhibition couldn't be better sited. At the moment, it's, let's admit it, no landscape painting. There's a huddle of old-fashioned warehouses overhanging a dismal, muddy foreshore. There's a brewery. There are some battered little back streets in behind the warehouses, which are sad and pitiful. And there's one ancient historic relic, the old shot tower, a survival of an arsenal which was there in Cromwell's time. At present, I'm afraid, it looks like any tall, old-fashioned brick chimney in the Black Country. But some wise and prudent person has decreed that while all else around it is demolished, the shot tower is to remain and be painted with fine black and white stripes. As such, of course, it can be the focus of the exhibition, and around it can be grouped all the pavilions and the gardens and the lamp-lit mighty wheels, and I sincerely hope the giants and the water shoots, the giant racers and the water shoots, which at the moment are rather hazy designs in an artist's preliminary sketches. I have a suspicion that the wise and prudent person I mentioned was the director general of the exhibition, Gerald Barry. I've known Gerald Barry now for about 17 years, and I've got a healthy respect and admiration for his capacities. His brother, who's now the Lord Bishop of Southwark, was my moral tutor when I was a freshman at Oxford, and a kindly and sagacious moral tutor he was. Gerald, when I first knew him, had just thrown up the editorship of a weekly review because he didn't approve of the paper's new proprietor or the new proprietor's politics, and he'd walked out and founded a review of his own, taking, I may say, most of his contributors along with him. And I, aged 22, wrote a letter to this new review of Gerald's about a young convict who I thought had been unjustly sentenced. And the letter was published, and we organized a petition to the king, and the sentence was changed, and it was all very stimulating and instructive. Later, Gerald Barry edited the News Chronicle, which is a big mass circulation popular daily with strong liberal leanings. And Gerald's tenure of its editorship, which ran through the fearful Murich and appeasement years and through the whole war, was distinguished and gallant and memorable. Because Gerald's running this exhibition, and because he seems to me so much the right man to do it, I return to what I began by saying, that I think there's a chance, more than a long chance, that the 1951 exhibition will be as much a landmark in the 20th century as its predecessor was in the 19th. It can symbolize hope and buoyancy and creative energy rising out of gloom and chaos and misplaced austerity. It can be an emblem and a focus of the sense of nationwide recovery, of rediscovered enthusiasm and inventiveness, and of a firm and cheerful determination not to slide into defeat, apathy, and fatigued second-rateness. It can symbolize the rebirth and the rebuilding of London, and of much, much more than London, too. And having said that, I'm going away from London for a couple of weeks. Tonight, I'm going north, to Scotland, to my own country. When I get out of the train tomorrow morning, at a small station where the train stopped, by arrangement with the guard prior to leaving King's Cross, there'll be a grey dawn across a chilly grey sea, and the smell of the wet-turned earth, and the big hills, and the plovers wheeling and mewing through the hiss and puff of the big engine, and there'll be Scotch voices. "Is it the Clare to Rathbun House you'll be wanting, sir?" And I'll know I'm home. And looking forward to that a good deal, this is John Connell signing off in London.
John Connell was speaking in the series London Letter.